What I wanted to try to talk about this evening is anger, which is a subject which we talk about periodically. It's been maybe about a year now since last time. And it's a subject which a lot of people will ask about if we have chance for discussion and people start talking about what's difficult in their mindfulness practice. They'll often ask about anger. It's one of the most common questions people ask about. And perhaps it's, you know, somewhat appropriate since to ask about it, since for many of us, anger is a major issue in our lives, and it's a major issue in our culture, and maybe other cultures also. And this is maybe a footnote or non sequitur, but I was reminded recently that the Chinese character for Chinese characters are often interesting because of the story they tell, and maybe half of the stories we make up when we look at them, but. There's a character for mindfulness in Chinese is made up of two characters. And the top half is the character for the present, or now. And the bottom half is the character for heart. And I thought that was a very nice definition for mindfulness. The heart of the present. The mind of the present. But it's literally heart. The heart of the present moment. And now the character for present, or now, is also is made up of different elements. But one of the elements that it's made up of is the element for a roof. So it could mean also, some people have said that the mindfulness in Chinese characters means the heart of the home, or the home of the heart, something like that. And whatever way it is, I think the opening up to the heart of the present moment, both to the situation at large, but also to our own heart, is an important part of what has to happen in mindfulness practice. And with that, and hearts are deep, like Thich Nhat Hanh is deep. Hearts aren't just simply seats of love. They're also the seats of courage, we say. But also, I think, things like anger and sorrow, grief, despair, happiness. The full range of human feelings sometimes is said to be experienced in the heart center, in the heart. So, as we open up our heart, open up to the present, it's normal, it's natural to become open to the full range, not only of feelings that we have, but also to our maybe more importantly, to our capacity to feel feelings. So people ask a lot about anger, and the larger category which anger fits under in Buddhist psychology is a category of aversion. And aversion is described to be one of the major, what's called hindrances, one of the major things which inhibits the heart from revealing itself, which inhibits us from being fully present, that keeps us from discovering what presence is really like. And aversion itself can maybe be divided into two forms. There's active or energized aversion, which anger is one type, is when your aversion is kind of, you're kind of getting behind it and it fuels you to act in certain ways. The other type, the other half of aversion, is what is frozen or stuck or debilitating. I think resentment, for example, is a lot different from anger. And I think resentment is often a greater source of illness and disease in the mind and in the body than anger is itself, because resentment is where the anger is held, the memory is held for a long time. Anger can be quite clean and finished with once it's expressed. So there's the active side of aversion, actively pushing things away, and then there's the frozen side, which manifests as resentment, guilt, depression, sadness, and such things. And both of these things have the function of isolating ourselves from ourselves partly, and certainly from the wider situation, from our friends and society. So I wanted to in talking about anger, I want to talk about it perhaps in a way that's a little bit unusual in Buddhism or in mindfulness practice, at least from many of the talks I have heard, and maybe some of them that I've given. And by trying to discuss first, or exploring with it a little bit, the role of our family or culture and society with our anger. Because the tendency in Buddhism is, and part of the strength of Buddhism and part of the weakness, is a tendency to always look within ourselves at how we're responsible for any given situation. What is our contribution to the suffering or to the situation? And so Buddhists are great at doing that, and Buddhists will spend a lot of time in a very self-aware in their contribution. But the result is that, but the weakness of that is that if it's one-sided, and Buddhists sometimes aren't so good at speaking up to what's happening outside of their own particular mental formations and patterns and reactions, and seeing what's going on outside in the wider society, and speaking up. And I think that in our culture, there's a strange paradox or tension or conflict between many elements in our culture which are provoking anger in the members of our culture, and at the same time giving us the message that it's not appropriate to be angry. And so many people find themselves in a kind of double bind, where you're maybe supposed to be angry, but you're not supposed to be angry. Men, for example, some men fear the consequences of not being aggressive or not being angry. Not being aggressively assertive or angry in many situations is for some men unacceptable. It makes them too vulnerable. It's a role they're not familiar with. And so much anger, I think, is reinforced by politicians. I mean, in the last couple of years, I think we've seen a lot of what politicians can do for stimulating anger and conflict in our culture. And I was so astounded to read in the paper, shocked that Newt Gingrich had said that the Democratic members of Congress had made a pact with the devil. And I couldn't imagine that, you know, a politician saying that about other politicians in our country. And our religious traditions, some of them drip with anger, certain kinds of anger, and a lot of people get, there are appropriate targets for our anger. So some people learn to channel our anger. We channel it towards certain ethnic groups or certain nationalities or certain kinds of people. And we don't do it towards our own people, but our religions, our politicians, our whatever, sometimes say, oh, it's okay to feel it in those directions. And it's been pointed out by, I think, sociologists and anthropologists and probably psychologists also, that dominant groups or individuals often will want to repress expressions of anger in those who are subordinate to them. And because it's threatening to have those who, if you have an unequal power system, power relationship, and it's dangerous, it's threatening to have the people who are under you being angry at the very situation that you put them in. And so people, often minorities of all kinds of different types in a culture, are put in situations which stimulate anger, which are harmful to them, disrespectful to them. And then the people who are in charge say, well, you shouldn't be angry. Or don't express your anger, because if you do, watch out. Something terrible is going to happen. And so the kind of subordinate, so-called subordinate groups are kind of stuck. And what often happens with if there's a society which has many different tiers, levels of subordination, that the subordinates then will take it out on the subordinates under them, because they're so frustrated and angry, they need to take it out somewhere, and so it goes down the ladder. And I've read accounts of this very same phenomena happening among women in our culture. Women are often considered to be kind of a minority in our culture. And women are put in situations in our culture, I think, where a fairly reasonable response, certainly an expected response often, is to be angry at the situation that women find themselves in. Though I think a lot of women and a lot of men at some point take the status quo for granted. And And so they don't see that the very situation they're in is a terrible situation. So someone told me the other day that I suggested that, you know, that she go for a walk around her neighborhood. And she said, oh, I got this letter from the police telling me that I shouldn't walk around the neighborhood here in Palo Alto because of this rapist. And how many women feel unsafe walking, even sometimes in the daytime, walking around alone? And how many of you take it for granted, that's the way it is, and kind of shrug your shoulders? And how many of you get pissed off? You know, I would think that it's appropriate to be pissed off a little bit, isn't it? Maybe. We'll see. But I think it's quite normal to be angry at such situations. But then also, how many of you, especially you women, feel that there's a message in our society that it's not appropriate for women to be angry?
Or assertive.
What?
Or assertive.
Or assertive. So what kind of situation do you find yourself in? You're in a situation which is terrible. You can't go for a walk in your neighborhood. And that should cause anger, I think. And then you're told, don't get angry. So you're... Pesha.
Learn to accommodate. We walk with a friend. Mm-hmm. I walk in the park. Mm-hmm. I always make sure there are other people around me. That's what we train.
Uh-huh. That's what you train. So, I mean, it's a wise thing to do. You should do those things. But sometimes, are they done at the expense of denying or repressing the anger or the frustration? And it's also pointed out, if I speak for women, maybe you'll quickly stop me if I say something wrong here, but that it's been said that that the only time that's appropriate for a woman to get angry in our society is when she's defending someone else, her spouse or her children, and that if you're defending yourself, then you're one of those kinds of women, which we don't talk about. Does that sound like it has a ring of accuracy to some of you? How many of you disagree?
Well, it's a lot better than it used to be. Yeah,
that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has improved. This is not a talk about women here, but it was kind of to make kind of an example. So anger is often repressed, partly a fear of rejection or isolation or disapproval, or much more serious consequences. And even small degrees of anger can feel very dangerous, so they're kind of put down. And so we have a number of excuses for not feeling angry. And one excuse people have is, I have no right or cause to be angry. The social order is justified, so the anger is unjustified. And so it's fine for, you know, whatever. I'm sure you can fill in the blank. But there's another kind of loop that goes on, and that is, if you feel like a situation is unjust and you feel like you can't be angry, or it's not appropriate to be angry, then you become a person who's become inappropriate. And so it reinforces maybe sometimes a tendency that something inadequate with you or something wrong with you. So here you are fuming at this, you know, can't take a walk around your house, you know, in the neighborhood, but you're told, you know, you're supposed to be angry. So, well, I'm angry. That's so, there must be something wrong with me. And then you hang out in Buddhist circles and part of the message in Buddhism is that anger is not considered to be a wholesome, useful, skillful emotion in Buddhism. So Buddhists historically in many cultures have been very good at suppressing their anger. Both in American Buddhist cultures and I believe in some Asian Buddhist cultures. So often the excuse is that I have no right to be angry, or I have no cause to be angry. Then related to this is the excuse that I'm unworthy. And kind of related to what I said, I guess, you're afraid of being angry because it will deepen the feeling that something's wrong with me. So you're afraid of your own anger because it's so threatening to feel you're inadequate. And so people subordinate minorities in our culture and in certain families. As it kind of becomes, kind of the tension or the anger builds and builds and builds. And the fear of the consequences, maybe sometimes awful consequences, the tremendous fear you have of people of themselves and their own anger because it's building, becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're afraid of showing anger because of what might happen, but it's repressed, and so then it might happen because it builds. And if it doesn't explode outwards like it did in San Francisco, I was very impressed by it during the Rodney King riots. When was it? 3-4 years ago? I lived, a block away from Market Street. And the protest march started, around that area and started walking down Market Street. And by the time it had gotten down past the Bank of America building, it had turned violent. And I went along, not because I was violent. I kind of followed the tail end of the protest. I wanted to see what was happening. And I was amazed at how much of it was an explosion of tremendous anger by people who I felt probably had finally felt they had a chance to vent it. And then another kind of footnote. I tried to read up a little bit about anger in our society, and it seems that some sociologists who studied anger were shocked to discover the degree or the amount of hostility conveyed and provoked by upper middle class fathers towards their sons. And I wouldn't have thought that upper middle class fathers was the source of a lot of anger. But anyway, I didn't actually read a study. I read a study about the study. But men tend to get aggressive. A generalization now is that men tend to get aggressive when they feel vulnerable, hurt, frightened, or isolated and alone, as do the rest of us. So the question is there appropriate anger? That's, I think, a very interesting question. And that's a different question than asking, is it appropriate to express anger? Because the expression of anger and the arising and feeling of anger are two different things. As some people say, that the feeling of anger and the venting it are different. And it's very important to be able to tell the difference between the two. But is there appropriate anger? And one way of understanding anger is that it's an integrity-protecting response to an invasion of our personal integrity. That if we have self-respect or sense of self-integrity, if something comes along and challenges or attacks that sense of self-integrity or self-respect, one response is to be angry. And the anger is a protection of our integrity. So I don't know if that still makes it appropriate, but it becomes a little bit different picture than just simply saying, anger is also always terrible and wrong. It becomes a form of protection. And it's interesting to reflect on that, not only when you get angry, about is this a form of protection, or when other people get angry towards you or see other people getting angry, what is going on there? Is it blind, rage, or is it a kind of protection, is it a kind of compensation for something deeper? And I think there's two kinds of sources of anger. And one of them is it's a integrity-protecting device or attempt. And the other is the kind of anger that arises from frustrated desire and identity. If we have a self-identity, and self-identity is not synonymous with self-integrity. If we have an idea that we're supposed, I'm always supposed to be pretty macho, and then someone kind of comes along and tells me, you're not so macho, are you? Well, that's my identity is being challenged, and so I'm going to try to, I might get angry. My identity and my integrity are not the same thing, but the anger that arises out of threatened identity, and the anger that arises out of threatened integrity, I think are two different animals, And can we distinguish the difference between the two? I think is interesting. Now, there may be a title for this talk is an appreciation of anger. Because I think that my understanding of mindfulness practice is we're trying to appreciate everything in mindfulness practice. We're trying to respect everything. And respect literally means to look again. So we want to look again deeply at what's going on. We respect everything. So the question is, how can we appreciate anger? Or how can we respect anger? And respect doesn't get much, anger doesn't get much respect in many circles, and maybe Buddhist circles particularly. So, but we're, you know, not a Buddhist circle, we're a mindfulness circle, and we're supposed to respect it all. So this is tonight's talk is an exercise in looking for the respect for how we can respect anger. And I think one of the things that anger provides us with is a powerful and useful recognition that something is wrong, of discomfort. And it can provide a motivation for action to bring about either the appropriate internal or external change. But I think anger highlights the fact that something needs to be addressed. And if you notice what it is that needs to be addressed, or what it needs to be explored, then maybe anger has done its work. So one way of seeing anger is that anger is a kind of suffering, or arises out of suffering. If there was no suffering, there'd probably never be any anger. So if anger arises out of suffering, then suffering can be a pointer, a finger, pointing at the suffering. And so you should thank the anger, you bow to the anger and say, thank you. And you go look and you study and discover the suffering. It's done its work, then you can kind of maybe let it, you know, drop it, perhaps. But so when you feel angry, or you see anger around you, I think that mindfulness students should never dismiss anger anywhere they see it, whether it's in themselves or outside themselves. But rather, mindfulness students should always enter into that world to understand where the suffering is. Because one of the great contributions that Buddhist or mindfulness practice has to our society and to ourselves is the willingness to attend to wake up in the midst of suffering and not turn away from it. There's a tremendous amount of turning away from suffering that goes on in our human life. I'm going to indulge here in reading something I wrote last week. This is from, I wrote, some months ago I talked about the ethical principles that I wrote for the San Francisco Zen Center. You might wonder what, And so that's his first document. The second document was the procedures for grievances and reconciliation for the Zen Center community. Our mindfulness community down here is not big enough yet to so, or mindful enough to notice. And so, the Zen is about the Bodhisattva path, which I think all of Buddhism is, but. As the Bodhisattva path is a heartfelt response to suffering, turning away or skimming over suffering through avoidance, rationalization, assigning blame, feeling self-deprecating guilt, or not listening deeply to the causes and conditions is to turn away from the Bodhisattva path itself. Furthermore, avoidance is often a condition for additional suffering. Read it again. As the Bodhisattva path is a heartfelt response to suffering, turning away or skimming over suffering through avoidance, rationalization, assigning blame, feeling self-deprecating guilt, or not listening deeply to the causes and conditions is to turn away from the Bodhisattva path itself. Furthermore, avoidance is often a condition for additional suffering.
question.
Yes.
Poverty is a constant source of suffering for me. And I want to know what you would recommend for...
Your poverty or other people's poverty?
Poverty of people in this country.
Uh-huh.
See as unnecessary.
Yeah.
And if I'm not to turn away from it, and it's a constant source of suffering for me, then getting involved at a certain level, I'm sure, is one way. It has been a way to ameliorate the suffering some. But I find that I have to mute or turn away from, occasionally at least, what's going on around me, or I can't go on.
Uh-huh. Well, if that's your understanding of what you need to do, then I think that's a wise understanding. I think that we have to realize that as human beings we have limited capacities. We're not fully enlightened, whatever that means. And so...
The more enlightened one becomes, the harder it is to live in this culture.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think it's harder it is to participate in many aspects of this culture. But I don't think you have to turn away from it and go live in the mountains. Like Thich Nhat Hanh, he puts himself right in the middle of it at times. So actually what he does often, he spends, I think he spends about 6 months of the year in retreat and 6 months of the year engaged. And I don't think I'm pretty sure that he feels that he's not capable of being engaged in the heart of world suffering unless he spent the 6 months on retreat. So there's a recognition that he needs to do something in order to create a balance. So that's one way. And so I think that understanding what our limitations are and understanding what the results are if we put ourselves in certain situations too much, understanding that the results are unhealthy for us is a wise thing to see. And then not to feel guilty because we're not being the Good Samaritan, but rather see, this is who I am, this is my situation, and then what's the wise thing to do given who I am? You know, and then you do something else. You avoid certain places, you avoid certain newspapers, you for a certain period of time until you feel like you're centered again and ready to open up to a small piece of it. I think that's part of it. Another important part for a mindfulness student is to investigate deeply the full gestalt of things that are happening in suffering. So certainly is to understand your own contribution, you know, to your own suffering. And often, even with very good causes, when there's good reason to feel empathy for compassion for someone else, our emotions get complicated. And so you might feel it's a little bit painful to feel someone else's pain. But you've gotten the message that it's not, you know, you've gotten this kind of nice New Age California message that you should be always kind of celebrating and joyful. And so suddenly your pain doesn't fit your image of always being celebratory and joyful. And so, well, something's wrong with me. And so you feel suffering because something's wrong with you because you're feeling pain, empathy with someone else. So that's an example of how we complicate unnecessarily rather than letting the pain or suffering be very simple and straightforward. And so allow ourselves to be an open channel for it. And I think what I've learned a little bit about in my years of practice is that it's possible to become an open channel to suffering and not a closed channel. And a lot of us are closed channels to it because we identify with it, we judge it, we evaluate it, we have all this reactivity to it. But it's possible to be an open channel to it, and that allows you to feel it fully. But it doesn't hang on anywhere. And then you can choose how to respond. Or you turn away, you go somewhere else, and then you're present as an open channel to someone's joy. Elaine.
I discovered in myself that statuses that just seem too deep to bear when I see them in other people, that without exception, the hurt that comes from watching other people in pain is because of some hurt inside myself that I wasn't acknowledging in some way. And it was how it somehow more acceptable to feel sorry for other people and to cry for other people than for myself. And when, and since it happens a lot, I find that when I'm getting overwhelmed, to just really back off and say, okay, what about me, what about my life needs to be cried about? And even if I don't come up with something specific, it always loosens me up to, respond to the person who is suffering in a skillful way and not all my junk on top of it. And in mediation, which is what I do, we love anger, because once someone gets angry, it's an announcement, I've been hurt, please see me. And it means that there's been fear, or there's someone's afraid that somebody's going to take something away from them. It is just, and then you can zero right in, and the person in no time at all will get to the real fear. And it's like your kid comes home late, it's 2 or 3 in the morning, and you're about to kill him, but you're about to kill him because you were afraid he was dead. And when you can spot anger and go back and see what did it, out comes love so frequently, or out comes I wanted respect and didn't get it. Out comes things that are so workable.
Yeah.
I think anger is just lovely. I love it.
So Elaine has that respect already, and I think it's a very good example she gave, is that anger doesn't arise in a vacuum by itself suddenly, but it's really a message that there's something underneath that that's actually something that's very useful to pay attention to. And it could, and if you're working with someone, if you feel angry towards someone, to just kind of find out what's under that for yourself, if it's fear or if it's hurt, can change the whole situation and make it a lot more workable. And I think, you know, it's been pointed out that, you know, we have a lot of repressed anger in our society, and we don't know how to experience our anger or express our anger and all these things. Now, that could be to some degree, but I think that the degree in which anger is so prevalent in our culture, I think it's sometimes a sign that the underlying fears and hurts and humiliations and isolations and things, being vulnerable and all that stuff, that is, we have no real experience of. That's repressed. And it's like, anger is like the second level removed from what's really happening in our lives. And so, you know, if you think that you're repressing your anger, you know, that's just, you know, the surface. And, I think it's very important to spend some time investigating our anger at what's going on under it. Because anger is a gestalt, is a combination of many different things. It isn't just one thing, like hurt or fear. It's often a lot of different things tied in. And some of it's unreasonable. It's our pride. Pride traditionally has been considered to be not a very wholesome state. Though nowadays it gets a better rap than it used to, more respect than it used to. But there's kind of this egotistic self-identity that anger can arise out of also. But that's also great, that's perfect. Because if you notice that, rather than turning away from that and saying, well, that's like I did now, kind of brushing it off, you say, aha, how do I respect this now? And egotistical self-identity arises out of something interesting. And maybe that's where the fear is behind. So everything should be respected. And Elaine wasn't going to let me get away with without respecting it also. Thank you. Yes?
Are you going to differentiate between identity and integrity? Because that's where you started, and I was waiting for the next bit. Because I don't quite understand the two sources.
I wish I had a simple way of explaining it. It seems like I should, giving this whole talk. But I understand a self-identity that's problematic is when we form an idea of ourselves about how we want to present ourselves or project ourselves and to the people around us. So it's a fixed, static idea of how we want to project ourselves. That's kind of that's what I'm calling self-identity. So I'm a rich person, I'm a smart person, I'm a beautiful person, and then you spend your whole life kind of trying to hold that identity in shape. And there's all kinds of variants of that. I'm a kind person, I'm a generous person, I'm a this and that, you know.
Would the identity be a mask? Our mask that we're wearing?
It could be. You know, the word persona came from the word mask. It's the Greek word for mask. And I think that it makes sense, a mask. As long as it's a fixed identity and we're kind of using it and propping it up, if it's fixed and frozen, it's kind of like a mask. Whereas integrity has to do with the inner sense of wholeness, of unobstructed awareness, the inner sense of wholeness, of self-respect, of recognizing there's something precious within us, very deep inside. And that something precious is something that we can protect or we can live out of or express. So who wants to help out here? Yes?
Well, I'm not trying to help out. I might make it worse. This is where I get stuck. Because when I identify with my body, myself, and not necessarily a persona, but even integrity, like staying alive, respect, I can understand it on that level, but with Buddhist thought, I constantly grapple with the idea that there's no way that my integrity can actually be undermined.
Can be what?
Can be undermined. There's no way that my essential integrity can be undermined. So there is no integrity. It's all identity. And then that's where I start to lose just living in this world, where I can stay aware of my anger. I like that. I like to meditate. I can really pay attention to what's underneath anger, and I can do that all myself. But when I'm interacting in the world, I always get stuck as to when I'm going to express it, when I'm going to deal with it internally. Because I could almost deal with everything internally. On some level, I don't then necessarily feel the intimacy with other people.
Yes.
In a relationship.
Yes, definitely. So how many of you feel at times stuck at that same junction? I think about all of us. I think it's a human phenomena to be unsure at times which direction to go. And the important thing is not deciding some fixed idea, you know, it should always be internal or always be external, or 30-70% or whatever. But to be somewhat flexible and change with the situations and be willing to make a mistake. Because when you make a mistake, then you learn a little bit better next time. Does that make sense at all? But there's no solution.
Just in the dilemma.
Yeah, so it's great to have a dilemma.
Where I get stuck the most is when I know in the moment that it's identity that's being challenged, and but I just it's so strong that feel it, you know, the anger that I get stuck in the moment on how to deal with it, because I either, you know, I can either lash out, which feels totally inappropriate,
yeah,
because they're just, you know, they're just kind of offending my pride.
Yeah.
Or if I start internalizing, then I feel myself cutting off from the person. And
So what you can, another alternative you have is to tell the other person what's under the anger. So you find out, you explore what's under it, and then you state it to the other person, and then you're no longer isolated. And it might be frightening. Or maybe you find another person who's safer to do it with. Or start there or something.
Or even to just state that you're angry.
Yeah.
Can help you lead to that, rather than act it up.
Yeah. Yeah. And stating, So I'll read another piece from this piece. So I wrote down five guidelines for resolving conflicts and disagreements. And the first one is being heard. It is crucial that everyone be given an opportunity to be fully heard. This means that everyone is given a chance to recount, without interruption, how they remember the history of a conflict and to state the feelings that they had and have in relationship to the conflict. It is important that such recounting be neither defensive nor critical, but rather be a statement of how a situation was personally experienced. Defensiveness and criticalness tends to preclude deeper mutual understanding. Much conflict arises and is perpetuated through a lack of mutual understanding. Taking calm and deliberate time to listen to each other is often all that is needed for reconciliation to begin. So simply stating you're angry without attacking someone can lubricate the whole situation. Sorry?
That's a good word. Lubricate the situation.
So we're late. And so it's not to get your wrath. So I hope this has been interesting and useful and somewhat unusual, I think, as a talk. So thank you.